available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
And a warm welcome to this week's Outlook, and from me, Nigel Hewin. This edition is being recorded on Wednesday, the 13th of March, 2024. And coming up, we've got an extra news item about macular dystrophy. We find out more about the 200th anniversary of the RSPCA. What about pink spy planes in the sky during the Second World War? We find out what the development at the Spencer Park Pavilion. And who'd want to be a snake catcher? We are going to finish off the story of the military wife from Joe Davis, and we're going to end up with Dave singing along with Visibly Sound. But of course, that's after all our usual features, but we're going to start, as ever, with the news with your readers, Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
Staff at Coventry City Council are set to have their contracts terminated in a long-running dispute over working conditions, union officials say. Unite says the entire refuse collection workforce will soon be sacked as part of plans for them to be fired and rehired. Bosses have been in long-standing negotiations with the Labour-led authority over changes to the working practices for the refuse collection team, and the removal of a rule which allows workers to go home when all work is completed, widely known as task and finish. All of the refuse workers will now be laid off and rehired, says Unite. Unite has described the move as totally abhorrent and entirely unnecessary. Workers in the refuse collection department have an active mandate for industrial action and are likely to strike at Easter, they say. Coventry City Council were said to have put forward several proposals to resolve the dispute, all of which Unite reportedly accepted. Unite says they have now withdrawn the proposals and will be pressing ahead with firing and rehiring workers. Unite National Lead Officer One Kassab described the move as reprehensible. He said Unite has, in good faith, been involved in extensive negotiations with the council and has accepted several proposals, only for them to be taken off the table. It is now clear that Coventry was never committed to securing a just settlement for its workers. It is almost inevitable that the decision from council decision will result in fresh bin strikes, and the inevitable disruption for local residents is directly a result of its actions. The council said, "We are looking to modernise the service, and as part of this, it considers that change is best delivered by having a directly employed workforce, with terms and conditions providing standardised and predictable working hours. It will allow us to keep the service in-house, providing a better service to residents, while ensuring a fair day's pay for a fair day's work, and also ensures staff retain the benefits of working for the council. We will, of course, continue to work with the unions to ensure a fair solution that benefits taxpayers, while offering a decent package to staff." Despite allegations to the contrary, the council has not withdrawn any offer it has made as part of ongoing negotiations with trade unions. Unite has put forward a proposal, but they were unable to achieve a collective position on it with other unions, meaning it was not possible to progress. At no point did the council put any proposal on the table, which it later withdrew.
A muted reaction from business leaders in Coventry and Warwickshire greeted last Wednesday's budget. The Coventry and Warwickshire Chamber of Commerce, which held a budget meeting with businesses from the region, said there was very little for companies. Chancellor Jeremy Hunt reduced employee national insurance, froze duty on fuel, and changed childcare support to encourage more people back to work. Corinne Crane, chief executive of the chamber, said, "We all wanted to see a budget that would support that growth, and I'm not sure that's what we've been given. The feeling in the room was that there could have been more for businesses." The cut in national insurance will provide a boost to staff who are still feeling the effects of the cost of living crisis, but that wasn't matched by the same kind of help for companies. There was very little for our manufacturers and construction businesses, who are still feeling the pinch from the rising costs that they have faced over recent years, and it was a similar story for hospitality. There was interest in announcements on £5 million funding for culture in Coventry to support the legacy of City of Culture, and for devolved powers going to Warwickshire, the latter of which Mr Crane said could help level the playing field over the likes of adult education. He added, "As with every budget and fiscal event, it's often the case that we learn more when the detail emerges. But I think it is fair to say that the initial reaction from businesses was fairly muted. The economy slipped into technical recession at the end of 2023, and while that isn't anticipated to last very long, more is going to be needed to build sustainable economic growth."
Octopus Energy says customers can get £80 off their bill if they pay by direct debit. And that is not the only good news for bill payers. The energy price cap is changing on April the 1st, meaning lower bills. So wrapping up that with a move to direct debit could be a big boost for people paying their bills. Octopus said, "Good to know. If you're not paying by direct debit, you could save a further £80 on average by setting one up with us. Your energy prices depend on where you live and how you choose to pay." Speaking about the price cap, they said, "On the 1st of April, the Ofgem price cap will decrease from £1,928 to £1,690 a year. This means that the unit rate for gas and electricity that customers are charged on a standard variable tariff will be around 14% lower for electricity and 19% lower for gas. Standing charges have been increased, but Octopus will keep their customers' standing charges below the price cap, unlike other large companies." They added, "Energy companies do not choose the standing charge costs. These are set by Ofgem and cover the cost of supplying energy to your home. The average energy bill across the country is set to reach its lowest point in 2 years from April. It comes after Ofgem dropped their price cap as a response to wholesale prices falling. Octopus says most customers on Flexible Octopus will see decreased unit rates and an increase to their standing charges. They say prepayment customers will see a fall in their standing charges."
Residents say they are frustrated after it was announced that they would soon be charged for having their garden waste collected in Coventry. Many have been left angered at the plans, which are likely to be implemented in April. Coventry City Council will soon be charging £40 a year for the fortnightly collection of brown-lidded bins across the city, a report has stated. Anyone who chooses to opt in for the service will pay the one-time fee and will receive a sticker for their bin to show that they are part of the scheme, it is understood. Proposals say that people can choose to opt out. Residents who decide against their brown-lidded bin being collected will be able to return their existing bins and will instead have to dispose of their garden waste elsewhere. Some slammed the idea as terrible. One said, "Why do we pay council tax then? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, getting my bins emptied is all I get from the council anyway." Another said, "Terrible. We pay enough to Coventry City Council and should not have to pay for our bins to be emptied." A third echoed this, saying, "I think we pay enough as it is." Coventry City Council announced the move as part of plans to curb spending at a time when they say they are facing serious funding pressures. Spending this year is likely to exceed £867 million. A statement shared by Coventry City Council reads, "Councils are required by law to set a balanced budget every year. We were already aware that there were serious funding pressures. As a result, we needed to take a long look at our services and have identified places where we have to make cuts. Although these are difficult decisions for our organisation to make, we want to be as open and transparent with you about them as possible.
A House of Lords cross-party committee has criticised the way the Home Office has approached the proposed transfer of Police and Crime Commissioner powers to the Mayor in the West Midlands. The Secondary Legislation Scrutiny Committee said it believes that elections are potentially undermined by the poor process. Concerns expressed by the committee included that the order had been laid before Parliament less than the minimum 6 months in advance of the next election on May the 2nd. It also hit out at the Home Office's processes in regards to the public consultation required by law were not conducted before initial decisions were made, which has led to the PCC, Simon Foster, applying for a judicial review of the order. The committee also noted weaknesses in the information provided, the results of the consultation, in which a majority of respondents who expressed a view opposed the transfer, were not reported. The committee concluded, "The way the Home Office has approached this change has been entirely unsatisfactory, and we have written to the department to seek an explanation for the flaws in the process of developing this legislation, including overlooking the need for a consultation." The Police and Crime Commissioner Simon Foster said, "The House of Lords has issued this damning indictment. This hostile takeover by the Mayor will mean more cuts, more chaos and more crime. The Mayor is in denial of the damage his government has inflicted on policing. Enough is enough. In the interests of democracy, the rule of law, due process and the rights of the people I represent, I call on the Mayor and the Home Secretary to abandon this cynical, divisive and undemocratic power grab." A spokesman for Andy Street said, "The Mayor remains laser-focused on taking the steps necessary to bring crime down, get West Midlands Police out of special measures, and help people feel safe in the region again. If the PCC had been focusing on that, then crime wouldn't have doubled in 8 years, and there wouldn't be this need for a change of governance."
A project to redevelop a huge part of Coventry city centre has taken a step forward. It means work to knock down old parts of the centre is likely to start later this year. Detailed plans for the first part of the City Centre South scheme got the go-ahead from the council last week. This part of the project involves almost 1,000 homes, space for shops and leisure, and areas open to the public. Documents with the latest plans reveal what will happen now that the final details have been approved. Coventry Council, as the main landowner, will serve general vesting declarations on remaining landowners on the site, a report said. This is so it can get vacant possession of the site in line with the compulsory purchase order agreed by government last year, and will take about 3 months. Once this is in place, initial work on the site will start around the third quarter of this year and continue for 2 years. A news release with the plans stated that the first homes are expected to be finished in 2027. And an archaeological survey of the site, looking for any remains, including the position of the city wall in some areas, will take place this month. Then, buildings set for demolition under the plans include Hartford House, Barracks Way multi-store car park, the City Arcade and its car park, and commercial buildings around Shelton Square and the Bull Yard. The new homes will be split across 4 buildings, and the site will also have public artworks, including replicas of historic murals by William Mitchell. Of the 991 homes that were built in this stage, 200 will be affordable, meaning available at social rent or shared ownership. Guy Shearer of Shearer Property Group said the planning consent comes after many years' work and marks one of the final and most important milestones in making this a live project.
Works are set to begin on a long-awaited regeneration project in Coventry. Plans will see the River Sherbourne on Palmer Lane transformed into a thriving part of city life. Councillors say the River Sherbourne will be opened up to the public, with cafes and restaurants also opening up on Palmer Lane. Contractors will be on site in the coming months, with the project set to be completed by December. Coventry City Council and the Historic Coventry Trust are funding the project, which will be costing in the region of £2.4 million. It forms part of plans to revamp the Burgess and Hale Street. Plans show that the project will include extensive landscaping, sustainability improvements and enhanced lighting. Bosses at the Historic Coventry Trust said the creation of a new public space will bring together the forgotten and historic area back to life. Standing by the River Sherbourne, Councillor O'Boyle, Cabinet Member for Jobs and Regeneration and Climate Change at Coventry City Council, said, "I am in the heart of Coventry. Most people who come here do not even know that it has a river running right through it. Admittedly, most of it is under our feet, but this project is to open it up to the public, to make it a bit more accessible and beautiful. It is part of our overall schemes that we are doing to make Coventry a much more attractive place to be." Councillor O'Boyle added, "It is a long worked on scheme, so I am really pleased that we are getting on with it now. It will be finished by the end of this year, and Coventry will finally have just a little bit more of the River Sherbourne open to the public."
Coventry City Council has announced a significant investment of nearly £20 million to enhance the city's roads and pavements in the coming financial year. The plans encompass over 160 projects aimed at repairing and maintaining Coventry's infrastructure, addressing issues such as road conditions, flood protection and road safety measures. The funds will target the worst roads and pavements, prioritising the repair of potholes and ensuring the safety of drivers and pedestrians. The approach is to tackle the most urgent repairs first, while also implementing measures like curb line repairs, junction enhancements, and the installation of bollards and lay-bys to prolong the lifespan of road maintenance efforts. The programme aligns with Coventry's vision for projects such as Coventry Very Light Rail, the introduction of all-electric buses, and the development of fully segregated cycleways to encourage active travel. Councillor Patricia Heatherton, Cabinet Member for City Services, said, "The additional funding is a welcome boost, and we will target it to help provide reliable transport routes that make it as easy as possible, especially for vulnerable people, to continue getting out and about in their local areas." The programme for 2024-25, approved by the Cabinet on Tuesday, is set for completion by the end of March 2025.
One of Coventry's historic hidden gems and its unique restaurant have joined a renowned hotel in the running for one of the country's most popular lifestyle awards. St Mary's Guildhall and the Tales of Tea restaurant have been nominated for the 11th annual Muddy Stilettos Awards. The venues are up for Best Family Attraction and Best Restaurant in Warwickshire and the West Midlands respectively, with Coombe Abbey Hotel up for Best Hotel. No Ordinary Hospitality, which operates all three venues, has urged the Coventry, Warwickshire and West Midlands public to show their support for their favourite attractions. Coombe Abbey Hotel claimed the regional title for Best Hotel in 2022, and the top five businesses with the most nominations in each category will go through to the regional finals, which are decided by public vote. Each regional winner will stand a chance of winning the National Muddy Award in their category in July. The platform, which has almost 4 million readers, covers the top things to do, family days out, and places to visit across 28 counties. Jane Pyatt, marketing manager at St Mary's Guildhall, said, These awards are a brilliant way to celebrate all the fantastic things to do and see in Coventry, Warwickshire and the wider region. And we are delighted to be nominated once again.
Coventry's dazzling Bling Road has found a new home at the Coventry Transport Museum. It sits proudly next to Lady Diana's car and is surrounded by pictures of the famous Coventry Ring Road. The Bling Road, a nickname for the Ring Road, is a special piece of art that shows off our city and what makes us unique. Local artists Karen Johnson and Mary Courtney made the Bling Road. They used their love for Coventry as inspiration. The Bling Road is a fun version of the Ring Road and city map, decorated with old costume jewellery, broken watches, buttons and more. This amazing piece of art includes special symbols like decorative mounds that represent junctions, each one telling a different story. From black and white decorations showing two-tone influence at one junction, to Asian-style jewellery at Foles Hill, the artwork is a mix of cultural and historical references. 30 people donated their old bling to be part of the artwork. Each piece tells a unique story, like a thrown-away tiara or uniform buttons from a Royal Marine. Just like Coventry itself, the Bling Road encourages you to look closer and discover the stories and places that make up our city. You can see this wonderful piece of art now at the Coventry Transport Museum. Artist Mary Courtney shared her vision. "We flipped Coventry upside down, like someone head over heels in love. So the River Sherbourne, bejewelled in blue, would appear like a beautiful smile." Karen Johnson, who helped create Bling Road, praised the local museum's efforts. "Coventry Transport Museum has done a fantastic job encasing the artwork. It looks like a precious jewel, full of colour and sparkle."
And finally, a news item that won't leave you feeling shortchanged. A vet was stunned after treating a dog that swallowed 133 coins, totalling £18.20, and weighing 680 grams. Charlie was taken to Thameswood Veterinary Clinic in Swindon by his concerned owners because he seemed under the weather. They were told the 13-year-old pooch was very constipated, to the point of not going at all, and had lost his appetite. They suspected he may have eaten a plastic art decoration, but vets were surprised to find out he had eaten more than 100 coins. A Thameswood vet spokesman said, "Charlie seemed to have been saving for retirement, because our vets found a rather substantial stash of coins in his tummy. Matthias, our senior veterinary surgeon leading the surgical team, subsequently removed 133 coins, totalling £18.20. They added, "We are pleased to report that Charlie is recovering well and is back home with his owners. His family have since donated the washed coins to the PDSA, which was a wonderful gesture. So much for piggy banks. Charlie is a doggy bank. Pet owners know their pets best, so if, like Charlie's owners, you suspect they are not quite themselves, be sure to get them checked over."
Outlook News.
So that completes your local news from Elaine and Peter. Now, as usual, lighting up and lighting down. Sunrise at the moment, 6:22, that's today, and sunset, 6:08 when it's out. Now, two weeks ago, I did threaten to give you the answer of the quiz last week, but I left the answers here, and somehow they did walkabouts. However, they re-emerged, so I can now give you the answers to those quiz questions. So, firstly, cowries are used as currency in some Pacific islands. What are cowries? They are, in fact, shells. Scuba diving. What do the letters mean? They mean self-contained underwater breathing apparatus. What are the Christian names of Torvald and Dee, who are about to retire from their world touring, Jane and Christopher? If the sun exploded, how long would it take before people on Earth realise it has happened. Well, it's about 8 minutes, actually. It takes time to get from, light to get from the sun 92 million miles away. It takes about 8 minutes. Which country did Paddington Bear come from? Well, I'm sure everyone knows that one. It's marmalade and it came from Peru.
Darkest Peru.
Darkest Peru. A bigger farm, thank you. And what fruit was formerly called the Chinese gooseberry? It's the kiwi. In Greek mythology, what was the nation of women soldiers known as?
Amazons.
Oi. Yes. You gather I have Hugh here champing at the bit to get in, but I'm going to complete this first. What animal was depicted on the last farthing coin issued?
A wren.
A wren, you're absolutely right, yes. And what are the Christian names of the three Bronte sisters?
Charlotte, Anne, Emily.
Absolutely right. And finally, in what year was John Lennon shot?
1980.
Absolutely right. Well done. Yes. So there you are. No prizes, just something to keep entertained. And I'll have another little quiz for you probably next week. So, in the meantime, here's Hugh to tell you what's going on here. After his little holes.
Yes.
How was your little holes?
Lovely hole, thank you. In Portugal, I can't say that the weather was much better than it is here.
Oh, really? Wasn't it?
No, got drenched a couple of times. But
warmer water.
Warmer water, slightly, only slightly. But anyway,
good. Nice break.
My husband Robert is very delighted because he got a really nice umbrella out of it, he's very happy.
And a nice break as well.
And a nice break, yes.
Yes, good.
And lots of seafood, which we both love.
So I see the sort of vague evidence.
Oh, how dare you, sir? How dare you? Right, my jumper is clean. I promise you. Right, okay. So, not vast amounts to tell you this week, but, you know, I can ramble on with the best of them. So, don't forget that we have the concert that is being done by the Heart of England Cooperative Concert Orchestra that Annette Ball is a member of, and it's the concert of children's music featuring Peter and the Wolf, and Peter and the Wolf is featuring Ian Loughlin, who's doing the narration of that, and then there's loads of other really good music to be had on that. Tickets are £10. We have a few here at the centre if you want them. Otherwise, you may well try on the door. Saturday the 16th of March is coming Saturday at 3 p.m. at the Bethel Church, and that's in Sponend. If you know where the Ramada Hotel is, it's sort of a bit next door to that. It's sort of in that general area. Hope to see you there. The concert is being done in support of us and the charity 99-1, but we'll be running a raffle there as well, so we've got lots of nice raffle prizes, including Easter eggs and a big box of very nice chocolates indeed, just as we get into the run-up to Easter. Talking of Easter eggs, of course, we have a big one, of course, in reception here. The idea is you have to pay a pound, choose a football team, and if that football team is the one that is the winning team when it's drawn from its envelope, then you get the 1 kilogram Easter egg.
So it's got nothing to do with the efficiency or the expertise of the team. It's a lucky draw of the team.
Yes, it's purely luck of the draw.
Right, okay.
Luck of the draw. Think of it as the FA Cup round one.
Yes.
And with an Easter egg.
Yes.
So there we are. So that's there. The Easter egg was donated to us as ever by the Lions, and it's a great little competition every year. So we'll be drawing that the week before Easter, so probably about the Monday, which I think is something like the 25th. Okay, so there we are. I'm very glad that Elaine is here to keep me going on the dates. I've got a groups. Oh yes, that's right. We started. There's a cryptic note to myself here. The groups for the satellite groups that we're are taking place around the city have started. So we've had three so far. One in Belgreen that just took place yesterday, and we've had one in Willenhall, in Binley, CV3, and where was the other one? In Jubilee Crescent. Holbrooks it was. That's where it was. That was last week. So there's one more in Canley coming up in a week or so's time. if you know somebody who doesn't fancy coming to the centre very much, but, you know, fancies joining in with a monthly group to talk about issues to do with sight loss, to get support that they need, then do get them to get in contact with us, and we'll give them information about when those groups are next on. Two of them are in the first week of the month every month. One of them is in the second week and the other's in the third. So anyway, it'll be a good thing for to get more people involved in that. And it'll grow, it'll get going. Goody has really been quite busy. She and Joe Proctor actually were, and Chris, went to a community centre in Canley yesterday, and because the Voluntary Action Coventry, VAC, they were holding a community day there, basically trying to get people to get involved more in volunteering, so there was a really good turnout there, so we're very pleased about that. We'll be going to one more, which is on the 8th of May, and that is at Jubilee Crescent. So if anybody you know is just thinking about perhaps volunteering, then perhaps direct them to Jubilee Crescent on the 8th of May, or just send them straight to us, and we'll happily talk to them about volunteering here. Now, a lot of you will know Sinead. Sinead Brady, who's our darling Rosie's granddaughter. She, as some of you may know, is also a theatrical type, and she is working on a collaboration with her friend Caro, who's from Germany. And they'll be putting on a piece for the when Chemnitz in Germany becomes the European Capital of Culture in 2024. And so they're devising a piece for that. And she's written to me and said, "I'd love to carry out an interview with one or maybe two service users at the Resource Centre. The idea is to ask them their thoughts and feelings about what makes them feel at home in Coventry. I think we'd like to speak to somebody 70 plus years old and born in Coventry, ideally, or if that's tricky, somebody's grown up in Coventry. I don't think it'll be tricky." So if you are interested in talking to Sinead about on tape about, you know, what it was like growing up in Coventry and what makes you feel at home, then do let me know, and I will make sure that you're put in contact. So she'll be doing it sometime in mid-April, I should think, so you know, get Easter or what have you over with. Talking of Easter, it being March and towards the end of the leave year, lots of people are having a bit of time off. So I'm just letting you know that so from next Monday, Joe Dickey is going to be off for 2 weeks. And then in the week before Easter and the week after Easter, so for the school holidays, Coody is going to be off. And then I'm going to be off.
Not
in the week
yet.
I am in the week after Easter. We have a new foster child coming, so we're going to spend a bit of time with him. So everybody who comes to the centre will eventually get to meet him. I'm quite sure he's a fantastic kid, and we're looking forward to having him come to us. So and that, I think, is about it. That's all I've got to say to you this week.
Nothing about Christmas cards this time.
Nothing about Christmas cards. I'll try never to talk about Christmas cards again. Ever again. Yes, but there we are.
Okay, lovely. Thanks, Hugh.
Thank you.
We'll see you next week.
Indeed you will.
Cheers. I know I don't speak for everyone, but for many of our listeners, I'm pleased to say that Sarah's vision has improved, so she's now back with a report on the past week's sport.
Outlook Sport.
Guess who's back? Yes, it's me, and thank you, folks, for your lovely comments, both when I've been up at the centre and on the tape. Anyway, I am back with sport. So, I'm sorry to football haters, but I'm going to have to start off with the City. Now, on the back of very successful 5-0 thrashings of both Rotherham and Maidstone in the fourth round of the FA Cup, Coventry have had rather a good patch despite a 3-0 drubbing by Preston North End. On Saturday, they headed down south, just a little bit anyway, to Watford to play Watford, the former and quite recently Premier side. Now, the first half was what you might call boring, and it was only made listenable to by CWR giving you regular updates from the rugby match at Butts Park Arena, but more of that later. Anyway, Watford scored after not too long. They were lucky, mind you, because both their defending and their attacking were pretty dreadful. But anyway, they scored. But fortunately, shortly before half-time, they, to quote Steve Agrizovich, upended one of our strikers, Josh Eccles. And we got a penalty. Hadji Wright steps up, they are American international, and scores. So it goes in at half-time, 1-1. But then R2 combined again partway through the second half, which again was not the best world's best listeners listening, when an excellent pass from Josh Eccles to Hadji Wright, who scored 2-1. And thanks to, again, dreadful finishing by the Watford 11, that is how the game ended. So City now sit 8th in the league, but only 1 point off 6th, which would get us in the playoffs. However, on Saturday we have a chance of getting to Wembley, because we are in the quarter-finals of the FA Cup away at Molineux, taking on Wolverhampton Wanderers. Now, the match is on Saturday the 16th, with kick-off at 12:15, and it's obviously going to be covered by BBC CWR, but it is also on the main ITV channel. And after that, there is a 2-week break for international matches. So, back to Butts Park Arena. Coventry were playing Ealing Trailfinders. You know, that team who've come to Butts Park and won on their last 9 occasions. They currently sit top of the championship and are on top by about 15 points, or they were before the match. Coventry, by the way, is second in that league, but have a match advantage, having played more. Anyway, the first update that interrupted the Watford boring match was Trailfinders 10, Coventry 0. In other words, Trailfinders had scored 2 tries within the first 5 minutes. Fortunately, they hadn't converted them. However, watch this. Not long afterwards, it was Coventry 14. Ealing Trailfinders 10. Coventry had scored 2 tries and converted both of them. And the match very much continued that way the whole time, with updates swinging one way or the other. But Coventry ran out winners 34-32 points. I mean, when you think about it, that is as likely as Ireland beating Scotland in the Six Nations. Or, heaven forbid, England beating Ireland. Oh, low me down. They both happened, didn't they, on Saturday? Still, never mind. Our local club did it. It was interesting to note, by the way, that the match, start of the match was actually delayed because there wasn't an ambulance present. And apparently they can't kick off certainly a rugby match, and I imagine a football match, without an ambulance there. Anyway, just going back to the round ball for a minute before I go on to littler balls with tennis. Kettering played Stratford at the weekend in the Southern Premier Central League, and Kettering ran out winners 1-0. Now, there was no match for Leamington this weekend, and having had a match earlier postponed, Leamington have now fallen outside of the promotion slots, with their place being taken by Stratford. But they're both very close. So, moving on to slightly smaller balls, if you'll excuse the phrase. Congratulations to Katie Bolter, who recently won her first ever Open. Now, it's not one of the major Opens, but it's an Open nonetheless in San Diego, and it netted her £100,000. So, it's no little sort of tournament. I noticed that her boyfriend had apparently won the Mexican Open the day before. And gallant guy, he boarded a plane at 6 o'clock in the morning to be with her as she battled to victory. So well done both. Sounds like a marriage made in heaven. Now, it's currently the Indian Wells tennis tournament. Indian Wells is really regarded as the fifth, or this year the sixth, because it's the Olympics, of the majors. I was sad to see that again Rafa Nadal's had to withdraw through injury, but delighted to see that both Emma Raducanu and Cameron Norrie have made it through to the third round, which is where they are at time of recording, which is Monday. But sadly, Dan Evans got knocked out. I was also a little surprised, I think, to read, again on the BBC website, that hopefully from 2025, Queen's will be hosting a women's tournament as well as the traditional men's tournament, which is always the last grass tournament before Wimblewonks, or Wimbledon to give it its proper name. Now, the women's tournament is scheduled to be, if the WTA, Women's Tennis Association, give permission, the week after the French Open. So it'll be towards the beginning of the transition to grass. But nevertheless, good to see that. Now, you may remember back in the days when I was recording before my eyes intervened, I mentioned the World Indoor Athletics. Well, Adam Fogg did make it into the finals. Yep, you know, the Godiva lad. Although I'm not quite sure how much of a Godiva lad he is, because apparently he's lived in Australia since he was 6 or 8. But never mind, he competes for Godiva. Anyway, he did make it into the final, but he didn't get a medal. But we did win some medals. Oh yes, we won 2 golds in the men's 3,000 metres and the women's pole vault, a silver in the women's 800, and a bronze in the women's 4x400 metres, which is pretty frenetic on that tight track. I have to say, I don't think I've seen Sebastian Coe looking quite so happy, talking about, wow, it's really exciting as we go towards the Olympics, because there are so many of our medal hopes who aren't actually competing here, and look at what we've won. So, fingers crossed, and it's not that long away now. Now, cricket. Moving to harder balls this time. Congratulations to Johnny Bairstow, who made his Well, he featured in his 100th test match of his career, becoming only the 17th man to do that. Behind, of course, Ben Stokes, who became the 16th man to do that. Both, unfortunately, in the losing test series against India. Yes, well, we won't talk about the 4-1 drubbing, which the last test match certainly was. But anyway, well done. And a big congratulations to the Irish cricket test team. They gained test status back in 2018, and they finally won a test match against Afghanistan, but it was a test match nonetheless. So well done, guys. And finally, now please, listeners, don't try this at home. But a former British gymnast who now works with Cirque du Soleil has set a world record for doing handsprings. She did 36 handsprings consecutively in less than 30 seconds. On finishing, she did confess to feeling a little dizzy. A little dizzy? My gosh, I wouldn't get further than about 3 and I'll be flat on my back. Anyway, folks, that has been your sport and it has been so lovely to be back. Have a great week. Bye.
13 consecutive handsprings. Just the thought, it's much too much for me, let alone trying it. What about Ollie Bearman then? Or Bearman, beg your pardon, he doesn't like being called Bearman, he likes being called Bearman, Ollie Bearman. Not yet 19 years old, and 7th in his first ever Grand Prix at Saudi. That's the name to watch. Now it's time for Dave and your postbag, so let's find out about your messages this week.
This is Postbag. Discussion.
We begin your postbag this week with a nice comment from a new listener to Outlook, a new member of the Monday Club, Elizabeth, and also 102-year-old Hilda of the Monday Club.
3-2, Elizabeth of the Monday Club. Are you enjoying the talking newspaper?
Certainly am. I look forward to it every week. Find out what's going on. Can't be bad.
Hilda, so what do you think of Outlook talking newspaper?
I think it's very good. Everybody seems to work very hard on it. And there's lots of things, of different things on it now. It's better than it's ever been. Congratulations to those working on it.
Thank you. Comments like that are much needed and help us to keep going. Thank you. Julia, on the other hand, says, I give up. This week is Torch Fellowship Week, and good old Nigel told us all about Lent and said we had to give something up. My friend John said he was giving up Lent. Jackie told us a story. Two burglars stole some jewellery but were chased by a policeman. The burglars ran up some stairs onto the roof and then they split up, so the policeman chased one, but he fell through a hole in the roof and was left clinging on by his fingertips. Hmm, thought the burglar. If I escape, the nice policeman will fall and die. But if I stop and save him, I will go to prison. So after much thought and prayer, he ran back and saved the nice policeman. The moral of this story is that he gave up his own freedom to save a life. So let that be a lesson unto ye. I'm not sure what the lesson is, though. Anyway, what are you giving up for Lent? I think I give up my friend John, or maybe I'll push him down a hole in the roof. That would save on licorice all sorts and sherbet lebens. Here endeth the first lesson, Julia. Edwina suggests an idea to help you remember where you got to in a book.
Hi, everybody. Are you one of those people that still got a little bit of sight with a small spherical circle? and you still determinedly want to read. I've got a reader, and I am very determined to keep up reading. I've got just one spherical circle, and it means that I see perhaps two letters or part of the word, and then move along the line and slowly read. But sometimes you get distracted, or you stop to go and make a second cup of tea. This is where my tip comes in. I use a paper clip, and I clip it onto the edge of the page where I'm leaving it, roughly on that line. And that means that when I come back to pick it up again, I already know the correct area and line because of the paper clip. It's much easier than keep going round and round the page trying to find one word to start again. Keep smiling, everybody. Bye.
Thank you very much, Edwina, for yet another helpful tip. Please send in one yourself. Last Monday I met Derek Headley in the tea room of the Resource Centre, and he gave me some of his creative writing to read out. Here's the first of his pieces entitled, Just Visiting. I stroll into the room a little bit anxious, a little bit scared, wondering what this visit will hold for me. He is sitting by the window, oblivious to his surroundings, blankly staring into the distance is my 86-year-old baby. I take the seat opposite, clasp his hand and says, "How are you, Dad? It's me, Sarah. I thought we'd pop in to catch up on things today." I don't know if he really understands, if he knows who I actually am. From my bag I retrieve a children's storybook and start reading aloud. I think it's the rhythmic melody of the rhymes he appears to enjoy, and for I do hope so, for my dad's pleasure. His joy, I continue to read aloud. I want him to take the book from my hands and read aloud to me, embracing all the characters with endless enthusiasm. He really enjoyed it, putting on an amazing show as he has done many times before, and all just for me. Exchanging the book for my mobile, in seconds music erupts into the room. The playlist is full of his favourite, all classic, every tune timeless. And as I saw my dad, I start to sing along. Shortly after, my dad is singing along with me too. He never misses a verse, keeping in time with the beat, tapping his feet. I really don't know how he's able to do it. I really don't care. I start to smile as I'm so glad to be sitting here, seeing and hearing my dad. On rare occasions, Dad pops in with a warm, welcoming smile and a twinkle in his eye. We smile, we chat, while my heart explodes. We reminisce about my childhood, my wedding, my kids. I've learnt not to cry. I've learnt not to hold on with too much force, to allow my dad to converse at a pace he dictates. Retracing steps on a well-trodden path, for me, it is a brief, fleeting moment. For him, I hope one more long lifetime. Because before the visit is over, he will revert back to the gentleman blankly staring into space. I gently kiss his forehead and says, "Goodbye, Dad. I'm off now. I'll be back soon." I wander off and leave behind my 86-year-old baby, my dad. My Friend, by Derek Headley, of the 25th of February 2023, he wrote it. Thank you, Derek, for giving me the privilege of reading that out. It was wonderful and so real. Please let Derek know if you like it too. members of the Monday Club are sad that hurdy-gurdy days on Outlook have come to an end. I am pleased that I introduced the reader, Alan, to Outlook, having met him at a winter warmer, recognising his talents. Graham recognised the talents of Australian television and radio star Barry Humphries, who was Dame Edna Everidge. He died on the 22nd of April 2023, and King Charles phoned him up a few hours before he died, because they were friends. Here's Graham.
It was interesting to hear the first part, at least, of the Barry Humphries article. Yeah, I listened to his Radio 2 programme, Forgotten Tunes. There weren't very many in the series, probably three or four in each series. And one of the series, which I think was recorded during the COVID outbreak, he tried to kid on that he was up broadcasting from his yacht off the Isle of Skye, but that's just his sense of humour. But it's surprising how many of those old musical artists finished up in Coronation Street in the 1960s. But the underlining point, I think, of that that article was the magic of radio. And I would agree with that. So I don't understand why, I should say, local radio presenters spend so much time talking about television.
Moving on to modern day entertainers, Amy went to a folk night in Long Itchington with myself and my two sons, Paul and Graham. Paul is in a folk duo called Yonderland. At Christmas, I gave Amy a charity single in aid of dementia with Casey Jones and another couple called Yonderland. And it was called A Folking Good Christmas, which included a song called Purple. Amy talks about the evening.
I really enjoyed all the music. I really did enjoy Yonderland. Yeah, I hadn't heard much of their stuff. I knew that song. When I am old, I will. Because that's already on the Christmas CD, if I remember rightly. So I knew that one. And I liked the one about the sea. The songs were nice and easy to join with.
Yeah. Sing along to. Thank you, Amy. That's lovely. That's Yonderland there with Purple. Do you remember the recording that Eric Sace once made in the Braille class of Lillian Bird? It was called When I'm an Old Woman, I Shall Wear Purple. She was brilliant. If you ask me in postbag, I can play it again. Thank you for your messages this week. Please, let's hear from you next time. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
Thanks to Dave there for this week's postbag. Now, before we move on to our general features, I've just come across an article in the Daily Telegraph, which is potentially good news for people suffering from dry macular dystrophy. This is a beautiful piece I recorded just a little bit earlier. Patients with a degenerative eye condition could keep their sight for longer thanks to the development of the first treatment for the condition. After successful trials in the US, a light therapy treatment which claims to help patients maintain or improve their vision is now available in Britain. There is currently no approved treatment options on the NHS for people with dry, age-related macular degeneration, AMD, which causes blurring or distortion of vision and can lead to blindness. Instead, patients are advised to manage the condition with lifestyle changes like eating healthily and stopping smoking. But now a handful of private clinics are offering a painless, non-invasive light therapy treatment which researchers say could help the condition. An estimated 700,000 people in the UK have AMD, with the condition affecting 1 in every 200 people over the age of 60 and 1 in 5 over the age of 90. There are two types of AMD, wet and dry. Both involve the deterioration of the macula, a tiny part of the retina at the back of the eye, which is vital for our central vision and ability to see fine detail and colour. Around 90% of AMD patients have the dry form, where the macula deteriorates as retina cells die and are not renewed. And around 1 in 10 have wet AMD, where abnormal blood vessels grow into the macula. Treatments are available for wet AMD in the form of regular injections into the eye or light treatment therapy, but there are no existing approved treatments for dry AMD. This new treatment involves a technique called photobiomodulation, uses LED light at different wavelengths to stimulate and reinvigorate cells at the back of the eye. A new glimmer of hope there then. We've talked about one or two anniversaries in Outlook already this year, the RNLI, the Radio Pips, and now Elaine reads an article from People's Friend about the vocational RSPCA inspector, a charity celebrating its 200th year of caring for animals.
It began a year before Britain's first steam railway opened, and while canals were still king. Sir Robert Peel was 5 years away from changing the country's law enforcement with the establishment of the Metropolitan Police. It would be more than a century before most women in the UK would be allowed to have a democratic vote. But in 1824, one fateful meeting in a London coffee shop saw the foundation of the Society of the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, the SPCA. Over the following two centuries, it has transformed the fortunes of countless million animals in every corner of Britain. As it celebrates its 200th birthday in 2024, the charity does so with women more at the heart of it than ever, ready to face challenges, old and new. That initial gathering took place at Old Slaughter's Coffee House on June the 16th, 1824. MP Richard Martin used to walk past Smithfield Market on his way to Parliament each day, David Bowles from the RSPCA explains. He was horrified by the treatment of the animals. He helped pass animal welfare legislation in 1822. But realised it was useless unless it was enforced. The meeting in 1824, which was also attended by William Wilberforce, who was known for his anti-slavery work, and theologist Arthur Bruin, saw the SPCA set up and two inspectors employed. We are still doing that same enforcement job 200 years later. The SPCA's pioneering example was copied in the decades that followed, and there are now over 200 SPCAs all around the world. wives of colonists in the then British Empire were instrumental in setting up animal welfare organisations that still thrive today. In England, Queen Victoria's interest saw the addition of royal to the charity's name. As Princess Victoria, she used to have dogs which were very important to her. She knew of the SPCA's work and was horrified by the dog fighting and their use in bullfighting. She started to help even before she became Queen. Ever since 1840, when it became the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, the monarch has been our patron. The RSPCA has played a huge part in animal welfare in times of war. During the First World War, it set up 13 field animal hospitals to care for horses injured during service, including the provision of over 200 animal ambulances. And the Second World War saw frontline officers rescue 256,000 animals who'd been trapped or injured in bombing raids. A lot of dogs were left behind when their owners went abroad to fight, and we also set up hospitals and clinics to try and look after them. For many decades, frontline work was very much a man's world. It wasn't until the 1950s that women were able to step up from their roles of serving on committees and fundraising. Society's attitude to women was changing. They started going out to work more after the Second World War. From the first two women inspectors in 1952, we now have hundreds. About 70% of our inspectors are women. Our inspectors need empathy, good communication skills, and a very good understanding of the legislation. The role goes back to the early days, investigating animal welfare complaints, giving information to owners, and on the rare occasions they don't heed that, then taking them to court. 8 out of 10 people we investigate don't want to be cruel to animals, they just aren't well informed. And getting information to them to help them change their behaviour is vital. Of roughly 65,000 animal welfare complaints, fewer than 1,000 are taken to court. Inspectors also need to be physically fit, as the RSPCA is involved in many rescues each year. They go to the aid of animals that have had falls, become trapped, or gone into rivers. As flooding becomes increasingly common, they are also frequently called upon to help. Owners will often refuse to leave their properties unless their pets are also rescued. While that's mostly cats and dogs, inspectors at a flooded house in Carlisle had to get a tank full of aquarium fish out before the owner would leave. Being an inspector really is a vocation. Obviously, you have to love animals, but you also need to be able to make quick decisions with compassion and understanding. The RSPCA has had a number of campaigning successes over the years. They've been instrumental in the introduction of legislation that has vastly improved the welfare of animals. But 2 centuries on from its foundation, it is still looking to the future. As problems from the past are solved, new ones emerge. The internet is one example, as a lot of animal abuse takes place online. They have worked closely with new legislation, which makes it an offence to be cruel to animals or post animal cruelty on the internet or social media. We have a strategy up to 2030 aiming to reduce animal cruelty by 50%. We have had to move with the times ever since we were set up, and we will have to continue to do that.
Another great charity doing wonderful work. I don't think any of us have ever seen pink elephants, but what about pink aeroplanes? During the last war, 50 Spitfires were painted this unusual colour to undertake low-level reconnaissance work. Bill starts reading this article written by James Murray in the Daily Express.
It is not a colour that would necessarily inspire fear, but emerging from the clouds at sunrise or sunset, the pink Spitfires blended with the sky, making them difficult to spot or shoot down during missions over enemy territory. Some 50 of the aircraft were camouflaged in the unusual hue to carry out low-altitude reconnaissance during the Second World War, though they are a rare sight today. In sharp cameras could take thousands of pictures as the Spitfires swooped low over enemy territory, the pilots risking life and limb to help Allied planners decide which targets to hit in bombing raids and other actions. A distinctive colour was officially known as Mountbatten Pink, a mauve-grey first used on ships of the Royal Navy to try to hide them at dawn and dusk. Images of the pink Spits are now as rare as hen's teeth. The few photographs that do exist were usually taken in black and white, which did not do justice to the striking paintwork. Now, however, a replica can be seen at a new exhibition called Spies in the Skies at the Imperial War Museum in Duxford, near Cambridge. Exhibition project manager Liam Shaw says, "Seeing a pink Spitfire close up is a very rare experience, and we are absolutely delighted that the public will be able to have that experience here at Duxford." The role of these Spitfires in reconnaissance was top secret. Even now, it is difficult to find much information about them. Getting the right paint colour was a challenge, but luckily, someone found some information on the mix of paints used. It was mostly white paint, with one part Roundel red. The replica, made of plastic with a steel frame, represents R7059, a Mark I fighter built at Eastleigh, near Southampton, which first flew in 1941. It has been given the fuselage codes LY of No. 1 ERU, Photo Reconnaissance Unit. Records show that the original aircraft was piloted by James Morgan on photographic reconnaissance missions throughout the war. Little is known about his individual missions. The missions were very varied, says Shaw. Sometimes they took photos of troop positions, and at other times they flew over sites which had been bombed to help assess the damage. The timings were carefully planned, so they would blend with the daybreak or sunset. Even to this day, it is unclear who came up with the idea of painting the recon Spitfires pink. I credit Sidney Cotton, an eccentric Australian inventor and aviator who became a friend of wartime leader Winston Churchill and James Bond author Ian Fleming. Cotton was fascinated by flying and set up a service to mount rescue missions for lost explorers in Newfoundland and Greenland. In 1931, he found and rescued British Arctic explorer Augustine Courtauld, who had become trapped on an ice field in Greenland. In 1939, MI6 operative Frederick Winterbottom recruited him to take clandestine aerial photographs of the military build-up in Germany. MI6 provided him with a Lockheed 12A Electra Junior, a small passenger aircraft built in Burbank, California. It was modified to carry a pair of downward-facing F-24 cameras and two Leica reporter cameras. Liam Shaw says, "Cotton was a very interesting character, a sort of Walter Mitty chap. He basically pretended to be doing passenger flights over Germany in the months before the Second World War. He was, in fact, taking hundreds of photographs. He must have taken a lot of risks to carry out this important work. The intelligence he gathered from covert reconnaissance was also passed on to the French Secret Service. There are claims the smooth talker even persuaded senior Luftwaffe officer Albert Kesselring up with him on one flight while surreptitiously taking pictures of a German airfield.
And more about pink planes next week. Now, close to home, Keith tells us about the development of the Spencer Park Pavilion, taken from the Earlston Echo.
The Friends of Spencer Park learnt on the 29th of June that their bid submitted to the Government Community Ownership Fund for funds to renovate and refurbish the Spencer Park Pavilion had been successful. A total of £155,000 had been awarded for the capital costs, plus approximately £30,000 for the first year of operation of the revamped facility as a community space and cafe. This was in major part due to the tremendous support from the local community at meetings via an online petition and with letters of support from many key people. Coventry City Council have also been hugely helpful, providing funds for the preparatory work on the bid and agreeing to lease the pavilion at a peppercorn rent. However, this award is just under half the funds that are required. The government money will not be released until the contribution they are making is matched, and this must be achieved in a relatively short period. The Friends of Spencer Park have drawn up plans the funding organisations they will approach over the next month or two, but there is likely to be a huge funding gap to bridge. Together with the fact that funders want to see the local community contribute, Friends are launching a crowdfunding appeal. The aim is to raise over £10,000. Peter Elias, who is leading the fundraising efforts on behalf of the Friends, said, "We think it is really important to give the local community the opportunity to make a contribution, however large or small that may be, to ensure that we achieve our goal to make the Edwardian Pavilion the centrepiece of the park, providing space for community groups to meet, subsidised by a modern cafe staffed by volunteers. Together with the renovated tennis courts, the two playgrounds that have been added, and the work done to run events in the park, this just shows how a community can rally round to make a difference to our local environment." Councillor Anthony Tucker added, "It's been a pleasure to help the Friends of Spencer Park set up their crowdfunding campaign to support the refurbishment of the pavilion. I want to encourage everyone in our area to give what they can to this vital community project, which will make a massive difference to the park and will benefit the entire community."
Snakes are not everyone's favourite reptile, but a 19-year-old called Silvio Marchetti keeps up an ancient tradition of catching snakes for his village's annual festival. Sue tells us all.
Francesco Zinatelli is no ordinary 19-year-old student. He is a serparo, an Italian snake charmer. As soon as lessons are over, he rushes to the woods surrounding his native village of Cocculo in Abruzzo, a wild and beautiful region in southern Italy. He patiently waits to hear the grass and leaves rustle, and as soon as he spots a snake, which can be up to 2 metres long, he leaps from hiding and catches it with his bare hands. "It's a challenge. You need to have sharp ears and be extremely quick," he says. "If I don't manage to catch any, I come back the following day. I love them. They're my pets, even though my arms are full of tiny snake teeth bites. Luckily for me, they're non-venomous." Cocculo is famous for its snake ritual on the 1st of May, when the statue of patron saint Domenico is paraded around the village, with serpents dangling from it. That helps to explain why the village is also a centre of excellence for snake charmers. 20 of its 200 residents are Separi. During the ritual, locals wear snakes around their necks and in bundles on heads and around their arms. It's a deeply felt ancient tradition handed down across generations and dating back to pagan times. But Zinatelli goes snake hunting all year round. My dad taught my sister and I to catch snakes when we were 6 years old, he says. I love being surrounded by nature. I've developed an instinct. I can spot their presence and I know all their hiding places and lairs. Last year he caught 15 snakes. He takes them back home and keeps them in a glass cage, feeding them eggs. Once I left one in an open plastic bag. My mum started screaming and we chased the snake around the house. Zinatelli says he's sad when he releases the snakes back into the wild at the end of the village celebrations. The snakes always bite him. He says it's like his hands are tattooed, but he's fine with it. Their teeth are smaller and less painful than those of a cat. Most Separi in the village are young men, but there is also an 89-year-old retiree who still charms snakes and some Separa women. Maria Rita Zinatelli, Francesco's sister, a 27-year-old bartender, enjoys wrapping the serpents around her body like necklaces. Daddy taught me how to recognise, spot and catch them. That's the most thrilling moment, she says. It's tough walking for hours in the woods, but I've never been scared. Serpents have always been part of our household, like a dog or cat. Marco Ognebene Mascioli, a 38-year-old local councillor and soldier, says he loves the adrenaline rush of a snake hunt. I go out on the hills by myself, says the Separo. My uncle taught me that there are two ways to spot a snake. They either camouflage or make jerky movements under leaves and branches, so you need sharp eyes and ears. It's a solitary, exciting game. He says a Separo knows where the reptiles hide because a snake tends to remain in one spot, moving around in a radius of 50 metres. Each year, when I release mine after the festival, they make their lair there for the winter. So when the next spring comes, I know where to find them, usually bundled together in underground balls, says Ognebene Mascioli. I know their habits. The best moment to catch them is when they come out of hibernation, still groggy and sluggish. Ognebene Mascioli, who goes snake hunting from March to May, has never run into a member of a species that could do him any harm. Venomous snakes, such as vipers, like humidity and cold temperatures. They come out at dawn, he says. I avoid going snake hunting before noon. It's in the afternoon that the non-venomous species are around. They like the sun. He uses a glove to catch the snakes and goes hunting twice a day with a pause for lunch in between. He says he and the other younger Separi are on a mission to keep the village's ancient traditions alive now that older snake charmers are dying. When he was a child and got his first bites, he admits he was scared. But then he got used to the tiny teeth leaving marks on his arms. They call us charmers, but we're nothing of the kind. If we did charm serpents, we'd teach them not to bite us.
That's certainly not a job I would volunteer for. You remember last week that Jo Davis started recounting her experiences as a military wife? Well, now this week she completes that story, including meeting the late Queen.
Diana and the Queen and the Queen Mum often visited the barracks with Prince Charles. What they'd do, the wives would be set out as at the side of the parade square. So they'd come past the wives first and say hello and just nod their heads, whereas Diana would stand and actually have a conversation. Then they'd walk over to the parade ground and they'd walk up and down the parade ground in between all the soldiers. All the gun carriages would be out and clean so they could see them. You know, it was a big day to have a royal visit. So they'd look all around there, then they'd go off to the officers' mess where the soldiers would have been cooking up a lovely meal, a lovely banquet for them, and then the lower ranking soldiers would do the serving and the running, you know, and carrying out drinks and things for them. The only one that wouldn't eat at the barracks was Charles. He would go in the officers' mess, but he would wait for his food to be coming from Buckingham Palace. He would not eat. The Queen would, the Queen Mum, Diana did, Fergie did, even Andrew did. I never met Edward, but Charles wouldn't eat at the barracks. He had to wait for his meals to come. It was really, really, really weird, and he was like, no, I'm particular with my food, you know. And, you know, and now I think, you know, with him being poorly, it just makes you wonder, you know, is it what we eat that makes us ill, or have we, is it in us anyway? You don't know, do you? So, yeah, so that's roughly how I got talking to David. We were talking about the royals,
yeah,
weren't we?
And
the argument with Fergie and Diana. And then also here, I do a Monday club creative writing on a Monday afternoon here. And I wrote a story, and I thought it would be quite fitting to finish my talk with the story. And I just hope you like it, really. It's not too long, but hopefully it'll make you smile. So this is about a visit we had at the barracks with the Queen. So, she's nearly here, I hear one of the wives say. I look around mentally, checking everything is ready. The parade square to my left is covered with all the soldiers in their smart dress, all shining and glistening with the sun's rays upon them. The space in between each line is perfect, and the space between each soldier as though it's been measured with a ruler. They all look perfect and fit for a royal visit. Even the horses seem to be behaving themselves within the lines, as no stomping of hooves or neighing could be heard. Then there is us, the wives, of them handsome soldiers. We are not so organised, but grouped together nonetheless at the side of the parade square. In the distance, you can hear the gates to the barracks being opened and the guards' marching feet on the tarmac in unison. Not a foot out of place. I hear them halt and guess they are doing their checks around the car for bombs or other devices, because even if you're royalty, you still have to have your vehicles checked when you're going on the barracks, because anyone could have tampered with it. And we had found, one time, Charles came in a car and there was a suspicious package underneath his car. So the whole of the barracks got evacuated, Charles included, and we were all in the married quarter end of the barracks. And it was a false dummy bomb, but it was still placed under his car. And there was a lot of trouble over that, because obviously it gets checked when it leaves the palace. And it was like, how has this gone unchecked? Or has it been put on while we've been on our journey to the barracks? But it can be done within seconds, a bomb being put on any of their cars, or even on our gun carriages. You know, they had to be checked since they come in and out of the barracks as well. So it doesn't matter if you're royalty or not, if you're going into a barracks or anything, you have to be checked for bombs. So even with privileged visitors, you cannot be too careful. The first car, diversion car, rests outside the officers' mess, shortly joined by the royal car. Housed with its Union Jack flying freely within the breeze, swiftly followed by the lookout car. Here we go, I thought, as the footman opened both the rear doors of the car now. Wow! A coordinated pale blue outfit, set of white gloves, a matching hat, and her handbag slipped gracefully over her arm, resting against her body. The Queen looks amazing, as she is joined by her mother at her side, also in a shade slightly darker than the Queen, but still a pale blue outfit. They look amazing, complimenting each other, anticipating whether either will chat to me, maybe remarking on my big bump, because I was still pregnant at this time, in front of me. So I'm constantly reminding myself mentally, it's Mam, it's Mam. I must then end all conversations with her as Mam. They walk towards us as the sun reflects off their beautiful outfits. The closer they get to us, the more beautiful they seem, if that's at all possible. They walk along the line of the wives, shaking hands, bowing their heads in recognition, having the odd chat with some of the wives along their way. I'm next in line. I remind myself again, remembering it's Mam. Don't mess this up. How long have you got left? Her Majesty Queen asks me as she bows her head in unison towards my bump. 3.5 weeks, Mam, I reply, as my insides jump with jubilation, as I've said it all right. I'm so proud of myself. Not long then, Her Majesty replies, and continues to meet the remainder of the wives. I then turn to the wife on my right and comment, wow, did you see her skin? Not one wrinkle. She has perfect skin tone. Forgetting at this point, I'm unable to whisper successfully. The other wife turns to me and says, what do you expect? She probably uses a £90 face cream. True, I reply. Then the Queen backtracks and is standing in front of me again. My heart races as she smiles gracefully at me and simply replies, Nivea, my dear. Nivea. Then she continues to walk back to where she was. I stand there and want the ground to swallow me up. I think to myself, great, my first encounter with Her Majesty the Queen, and this happens. I glance at the major who is escorting her along the line. I'm sure I see a slight grin at the corner of his mouth. Why me? And that's true. So the Queen and the Queen Mum used Nivea.
Certainly some interesting and lucky opportunities there, being a military wife. Dave's a regular visitor to the Monday Club here at the centre, and at a recent meeting, not only did he chat with some of the talented members of Visibly Sound, but was also invited to sing along with them.
I'm here at the Monday Club with Visibly Sound, and I've been invited to take part with Visibly Sound, as we're a bit short on numbers. So, great, I'm standing next to Charlie, so how's your saxophone playing going?
Okay, not too bad. Still need a lot more practice.
Yeah, how long have you been playing for?
Oh, since I was about 16, so I'm 72 now.
Yeah.
So.
And you've been playing in bands in the past, have you?
Yes, I've played in bands in the past, yeah.
Anyone we might know?
Probably the most famous one you might know, if you got hit records of 1976, is Jimmy James and the Vagabonds.
Heard of them, yeah.
They had two hit records in 1976, so I was in them for a short while. And I was in a Birmingham band called the John McFlair Band that backed many hit recording artists such as Del Shannon, The Drifters, Edwin Starr, Benny King, people like that as well, for a while.
And now you join Visibly Sound. Fantastic. You're enjoying
I lost my eyesight in September of 2018. Well, most of my eyesight, so yeah. I joined the Resource Centre and now I'm playing along with Visibly Sound. Yeah, keep me handing on the saxophone a little bit. That's about as good as it gets for me. No more playing in bands.
Yeah, you mentioned once when I met you at a fun day at the Resource Centre that anyone could play the saxophone. If they can't see, you can still play the saxophone. Is that right?
Oh, yes, because you don't look at the keys with your fingers. Your fingers just followed down the keys, so you can be blind and play it, no problem. The only thing you can't do is obviously reading music or reading a tutor book, so you can't see it. But you play by ear. That's fine, you know.
Speaking to Amy now, you can hear Charlie tuning up in the background, the saxophone. How are you getting on with Visibly Sound and the music and everything?
I'm enjoying it as much as I ever did. I think it got much better over the years, and whether people mind me saying or not, I'm gonna say it. I feel that it's much better now. We do a much more of a variety of songs, old, modern. It's always good to mix it up a bit.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they tend to give a really polished performance as well, don't you all?
Well, I don't know about that, but I'm glad you think so, David.
I think so, yeah.
We try.
Newspaper. Hello, I'm speaking to Philip King.
Hi.
How do you feel about joining Visibly Sound with your keyboard playing?
I wasn't quite sure at first because I normally do solo gigs at various nursing homes, so I haven't really tried many groups except for a band in Birmingham where I play for a little while with a group, but it was all rock and roll and I wasn't all that keen on boogie woogie, but I still played anyway.
You sound absolutely brilliant. Anyway, fantastic stuff. Thank you very much. Great to see you again.
Hello,
I'm speaking to Stephen. So you've come along to the Monday Club. So what brings you along to the Monday Club?
Oh, I like singing and doing things in the Monday Club.
And you and your friend Michael, you've come along to join, to support Mark.
To support Mark,
that's
yeah.
Fantastic, who's singing with the Visibly Sound. Fantastic, thank you. We enjoyed it,
yes.
Stephen.
Yes, I enjoyed it greatly.
I'm speaking to Hilda, so what do you think about the morning with Visibly Sound?
I thought it was excellent. We had a lovely morning because the sun was shining and we had music. What more could you ask for?
Thanks a lot. That's all from the music group for the visually impaired Visibly Sound at the Monday Club, Coventry Resource Centre for the Blind. Bye for now.
And Dave and Visibly Sound bring us to the end of Outlook for another week. So from me and the team, that's me, Nigel Hewin, that is, and the team, it's goodbye till next time.